In the course of our reading of the story of God's work amongst men, we have come to Israel as a nation, and we have seen the nation being brought under God's promise, under His protection, under His provision, and brought to the mountain of God, Mount Sinai. We found in chapter 19 that they were then required to make preparations around this mountain, preparing to be ready for God to speak with them, to speak to them as a nation, not just to speak to individuals as He had done by and large thus far, but to speak to them nationally as His chosen people. And I think in most cases, if something like this arose, even for a much lesser personage than the Lord Himself, one might say, question, in such circumstances, what will this person be saying to us? He's summoned us. He's asked us to prepare in a very special way. What is He going to say? And how is He going to speak with us? They knew a little, presumably, of the Lord by this time. These questions perhaps could well be in mind. And so all these preparations, and then we begin chapter 20 of Exodus, where God spoke all these words as follows, saying, He gives the law, beginning with what we call the Ten Commandments, the ten words sometimes described as, if you hear somebody speaking of the Decalogue, they mean it's a word that is made up of two parts, deca, meaning ten, and logos, being commandments or words. That's all it is. But just in case you find some preacher coming along and breezing through and saying, speaking of the Decalogue, that we make sure we do know that that's all he's talking about. It's a fancy word for the Ten Commandments. Here in Exodus 20, from verse 3 through to 17. Now, there's a couple of things that I just want to highlight with regard to this. First of all, that the form of address is highly unusual. I've already said even this evening that thus far the Lord had tended to speak to individuals. And for Israel, to this point, God had been speaking through Moses. It tells, the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and say, and so on. So it is highly unusual, and it indeed remains highly unusual through the rest of the story, that God should speak. And the way that it's said, it would, being so different, it would suggest that God was, in a very different way, speaking directly to the people, the assembled gathering. And this would explain, too, the fear that is spoken of in verse 18 and 19, that where we started our reading this evening. Little wonder when they saw the thunderings, lightning, sound of trumpet, the mountain smoking. The people saw it, they trembled, and they stood afar off. They were afraid of this God who spoke with them at that time. And so what did this God say? This God, first of all, gave them a brief introduction, telling them who He is and what He has done for them. What has happened thus far? And He tells them this as the grounds for what goes on, what follows from here. And I spend a moment on this because this is very reminiscent of basic covenant structure. Can I just, I can't even recall, I'm afraid, whether I've spoken of this before, but there's no harm in reminding ourselves in any case that in those days covenant was a very common type of expression. It was already known to people in Abraham's day and so on. And in a covenant, it was generally speaking between two opposing nations. Nations, obviously, in those days could be very small, but they would be in opposition to each other. You read much later on that there was a time of year when the kings would go out to war. It seemed to be the ideal conditions that they could go and fight one another. And they would do that to try and expand their kingdoms and so on. And after the battle, the two nations, represented by their leaders, would come together and they would make a covenant, a treaty. And to do this, key elements in it, first of all, they would set out who they were, and they would set out who was the superior, who was the inferior, the one who had lost the battle, for example. And the reason for that was that it would give them the grounds. If one can say, I am the victor, I am the vanquished, then the one who is the victor, he was establishing the grounds for what he was going on then to say to the ones that he had vanquished, that he had won the battle over. And it's something very, very like that in this case. That God is able to say to the people, think about who we are, who is talking here. I'm one side, you are on the other side. I am talking to you, and therefore I'm going to tell you something, and I have the right to do so. Because I am the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Let's remind ourselves of where we've come from. Let's tell the history, albeit briefly. Let's remind ourselves of who we are. I am this person, the Lord your God, who did this for you. I brought you out of Egypt. Stop and think about that for a moment. And then let's go on from here. And so very often in covenants there were clauses like this of introduction of the people involved and the history behind it. And that's what you have in chapter 20, verse 2. And that becomes, or must remain, fundamental to what follows. There's an unspoken because, almost, between verse 2 and verse 3. Because of what has happened, because of what I have done, therefore you shall have no other gods before me, and so on. And so we come from verse 3 to verse 17, initially, with what I would call stipulations. Requirements. These 10 words, the 10 commandments. Now again, if you were to take the picture that I've just painted very briefly of the two nations fighting each other, and they come and they try and make a settlement, a treaty between them, the clauses and the requirements of that from the superior to the inferior, those requirements were not necessarily new all the time. They would perhaps borrow arrangements between two groups of people that had been used before and make use of those again. And perhaps it's worth our while realizing that, because many of these points that are raised in what we know as the Ten Commandments are things that have been there before. They are being, shall we say, codified, set together in one unit for the people. But essentially what's happening here is that the people are being reminded of their redemption. Stop and consider your redemption. And now live as I direct and as I instruct. God is speaking along those lines. And it reminds me of what Paul says in the New Testament, writing to the Corinthians. And he says, it's the love of Christ that constrains us. God says, I have done this, I have redeemed you. it's an expression of His love. That should be your constraint. That should be the thing that pushes you on to obey and to observe the stipulations that I set before you. And so this is very much along the lines, the build-up of a covenant relationship that God is setting between the people and Himself. The response to this particular expression, and I do believe that those words, as recorded there, I would assume by Moses, from verse 2 to verse 17, that these were spoken very directly to the whole nation. Now, it may be that some of the people, all they could see was the noise and the smoke and the thundering, and so on, much as when Paul or Saul was met by Jesus on the road to Damascus. He heard the voice. The people around him just heard or saw the great light and a great noise. And there may be some people who were unable to understand immediately what God was saying, but they knew that God was speaking to them in a mighty and a powerful way. And their response was what I would really call the paradox of fear, and I don't think this should ever be something that only the Israelites at Mount Sinai would experience. I think this is really the way that it should be for all men, to be aware of the majesty of God. What does Moses say to them? Do not fear. That's one thing. But immediately he goes on to say, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be with before you. Don't fear, but that fear needs to be before you as well. And it's one of the difficulties that we have in English of expressing fear. But it's not a panicky fear. It's not an untrusting fear. It's not a paranoia or anything of that sort. It's not just utter terror that they might have felt when these things were happening, and as many of us perhaps would feel when we first encountered something like this. So don't fear, don't be afraid, but at the same time, that there should be a fear of God, to recognize who He is, that He's way beyond our capacities and so on. And so I just would signal that we need to recognize that there's this what I would suggest is something of a paradox. Don't be afraid, but is the fear of God on you? This is the same God that we deal with today. We're no greater people than the people of Israel were then. God is no lesser God than He was then. Our approach to Him should be along much the same lines. But taking just a glimpse through this vitally important experience of God's people, there are some interesting passages that follow from verse 22 of chapter 20 and onwards. And the way I would describe this, the category, if you like, of this would be that I think these are applications of that law. Those fundamental covenant stipulations, but now there is some application being made of them. But it's still within the covenant context. There are still regulations being set out before the people, but they are essentially applications of these most basic form commandments. For one thing, this is not being spoken to the people in the same way as the first part of chapter 20. Now we find that there's a reversion to the old pattern that the Lord said to Moses in verse 22. Thus you shall say to the children of Israel. It's at a different level, shall we say. Not so quite so fundamental. But you can take a number of the examples from here, and you can see how they are rather applications, developments, How are Israel supposed to live out some of these Ten Commandments? That's what it's about. Take, for example, where the first one, where God speaks to them about worship. You've seen that I've talked with you from heaven, as if to say, these other things come. You will not make anything to be with me. There is nothing else. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first of the commandments. No gods of silver, no gods of gold. You shall not make any carved image. He's reminding them of this and just applying it to them. Then there's the altar. Now, altars are not mentioned in the Ten Commandments. But this is about how to worship God. The right way of sacrifice. The right manner of worship. And this kind of thing is founded upon Commandments 1 and 2, which talk about his authority, which talk about what is appropriate to worship this Almighty God. And you can go on through the various other ones there as well. That's one concerning the religious aspect of life. There are others concerning civil aspect of life. How do you behave within society? And there are a great deal more of these that will follow eventually, but there is a certain set that is contained here initially. The one regarding violence, for example, in chapter 21. Chapter 21, verse 12, it talks about, essentially about murder. In the first, the commandment, you shall not murder, in 20, verse 13. There's something more said about it, how it is to be understood, how it is to be applied in life as it might occur. You see, when you have it in its most basic form, as it is in the first part of chapter 20, an understanding of application doesn't come easily to men. We do need some direction as to how to understand it, how to apply these things. We only need to go to our catechism study evenings to realize that we have to spend a lot of time trying to get a hold of what's a clear understanding of these things. And that's what's happening here. That if the people only had the first part, they were still very new to these things. And it was crucial for them, as they were to go on and develop as a nation, that they should have some further specification regarding this. You could almost think of it something along the lines of a first draft that is yet a working paper, guiding people. This was to be built on and developed further at a later stage as well. And then dealt with differently again as they were preparing to enter the Promised Land much later on. And so that you find in this section from chapter 20, verse 22, there are instructions concerning worship and sacrifice. There are instructions concerning servants. Now, this is something you might say, well, why this? Well, how are you going to live towards your servants? They were inevitably going to have servants. Get this into place right at the beginning. God sets it out for them to show you how to behave towards them. There are issues that are majored on even within that heading as well. We just don't have the time to go into it. There's violence as well. Awareness too that you have animals that can cause injury and so on. And so that men are responsible for their beasts and the consequences too. There's issues of property dealt with and about stealing in chapter 22. That goes on for some period as well. Then there are what tend to be called moral issues. Now, I sometimes find that people, when they use speak of a moral problem, these days tend to be really using it as a euphemism, a nice way of saying that somebody's been misbehaving in a sexual way, adultery and so on. But there's a lot more than to moral matters than that. It's It's really about how attitude directs our lives and attitude-directed living. That's what moral matters are about, moral behavior. And that's what is being dealt with at the end of chapter 22. Chapter 23 begins by talking about justice, issues of justice and of truth, how you behave. And for example, you shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in this dispute, chapter 23, verse 6. As the chapter itself begins, that it's about not bearing false witness against your neighbor, maintaining the truth, maintaining justice. There's also the matter of the Sabbaths, issues of rest, adequate rest, even for the land, in 23:10 and following. And then there's further about worship of God in the annual feasts in 23:14 through to 19. So there are a number of things that had to be set in place fairly early on, a bit of some expansion, applying the Ten Commandments to issues that the people were going to face from an early stage. So there is application, just a survey of it. And there's a lot more detail that God goes into at a later stage with Moses. So we have the introduction, as you would find in a typical covenant relationship and treaty. You have stipulations also, according to a typical covenant format. And then you have a third element, which is also typical of covenant, and that is promise. See, you have, again, the two kings, to take that picture. One has overcome the other, and he says to that weaker nation, he says, now, remember all this, now you need to behave in this way. I want you to pay tribute and so on. That's what I'm expecting from you. But that would be very one-sided. And it was, again, a very common thing for them to then turn around and say, if you do that, if you are consistent in that, then I promise to do this. And that's exactly what God is really doing here. From chapter 23, verse 20, he makes promises to them. He makes an undertaking. Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. You might remember I placed a great deal of emphasis as we were going through chapter 6 of Exodus upon the seven I wills that the Lord said to Israel. It was wrapped up in, he said, I am the Lord, I am the Lord. And in there he said, I will do. And he said seven things. And he said, I will redeem you out of Egypt, but I will also take you into the land. And that's what we have reminded to Israel here. I have now brought you out, is the history. But I promise, if you uphold these stipulations, I promise to take you now into that land, to complete that promise, the undertaking that I have made. There is an angel spoken of here, just along the way. This is generally understood to be one of the places where we have some reference to the Son of God, the second person in the Trinity, appearing pre-incarnation. It's the incarnation of Jesus in particular. Before that, the Son does appear, it seems, in this kind of way. It is the way that God chooses to reveal himself as he comes amongst his people. But notice what he says about the angel. It's not just what we might normally think of as an angel, another person, another spiritual being. But what does he say about this angel? He says, beware of him in verse 21, and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. Doesn't say that he is unable to, an angel would be unable to, but he says he will not pardon your transgressions. Why? Because my name is in him. It's, again, a most unusual way of speaking, but I think it means that it's a reminder that this is, yes, called an angel, but this is another person of God, shall we say, the Son of God, the second person who is coming amongst his people in this way, with all the difficulties that we have, of course, of expressing these things adequately. But along with the promises, God also speaks to them in caution and warning. He says, I will do all these things. I will send my fear before you. I will pace it perfectly, that they won't, the place won't be empty before you're ready for it. All of these things. I will set your bounds. But in verse 32 and 33 of chapter 23, you shall make no covenant with them nor with their gods. I will do all of this, but you still be very, very careful that you don't fail at the end. You need to make sure still of these things. No other gods before me. If you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. And so there was the introduction, the history, the parties involved, there were the stipulations to those who were subject, there were the promises from the sovereign to them. And then the next stage is agreement. He has dictated the terms thus far. And then you get to chapter 24, and all these words were then passed on to the people. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the judgments in chapter 24, verse 3. And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said, we will do. They were accepting these terms. There was an agreement to this covenant, this treaty between them. God spoke first directly and through Moses, and here the people respond, we will do whatever he has said. I must say, when I read it, it seems that they were blithely unaware of the magnitude of the task in front of them. But could they have said anything else? You don't say anything else to the Almighty God. This was the appropriate covenant response. And so the Lord takes it on from there. They repeat this a little further on as well in verse 7. When he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people, they said exactly the same thing. And so what's the next step that's required, and indeed the final step, is the covenant seal. Now, there's a slight mistake on the sheet. It's just mentioned verse 11. It should also have mentioned verses 5 through to 8. In verse 5, you see the sacrifices, the burnt offerings that were to be made. But of course, when these animals were killed, there was blood flowing. Blood was vital to this. Moses took the blood, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And then, having this agreement affirmed again by the people, again striking terms, I think, in verse 8, when Moses took the blood, he sprinkled it also on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant. Do you remember, and we'll be using the words again next week, where Jesus said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Behold the covenant of the Lord, the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you according to all these words. Now I knew this was coming, but the term covenant there. But not a single step thus far has had to be squeezed into this structure. It's all there. This is a new covenant, a renewing of the covenant really, that has begun with Abraham. with the people of Abraham long before, and is now being reiterated and expanded and set out in a national form for Israel. And it was sealed first with the sprinkling of the blood, that the blood was what had covered them to bring them out of Egypt. It was also to cover them now in entering into this covenant. But it is not just the blood of the covenant that was needed in the sealing of it. There was a further step, and that's expressed in verse 11. We come to that by finding Moses and his brother and his brother's sons, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, who were taken up, so far at least, on the mountain. And they saw God, the God of Israel. It is obviously very difficult to describe such a sight. It were under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone. It was like the very heavens in its clarity. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. God doesn't eat and drink. He's not a physical being. But they ate and drank. That was, again, a common occurrence in the finalization of the covenant, that you eat and you drink together with two parties involved. And they were eating and drinking in the presence of God. This God who had been so fearful and terrifying to them, they ate together. You see, you can't eat together with an enemy. The enemy might poison your food. When you're eating, you're unguarded, an unguarded moment. You're vulnerable. You don't eat with enemies. But you eat with friends. You eat with those that you've entered into agreement with, an undertaking, covenant, a contract. And so there was the blood to seal that covenant, just as it was in Abraham's day. The blood was spilt to confirm life depends upon this covenant. All the stages, all the elements of covenant are here. I want to bring you back to the fact that this passage dealing with God's meeting and expressing his covenant terms with the people, that is where you find the Ten Commandments. Within that, it's set in as a part of that. We must be very careful that we don't just take these things in isolation and out of their context. And we're very tempted to do that sometimes with the Ten Commandments, failing to realize that it is set in the context of God's covenant agreement with his people. And the importance of that is that the people were not being just left to themselves, not being told, do this, don't do this, don't do that, which is exactly the way it's so often treated today, isn't it? Set up on a wall somewhere, whatever. Maybe we do it even in church when we repeat it, but we mustn't. Because when this was set up, what we also find, we find that God says, I am the one who's redeemed you, therefore I say it. He goes on to say, I promise to achieve this for you. And he deals with it. Finally, he seals it with blood and with this meal together. Not a case of God setting this out in front of the people and saying, all right, now let's see if you can do it. But he says, I will be with you. I will be there to enable you to achieve it. Although even with the Lord's presence, we know, of course, that they did fail time and again. But let's remember that when the law is expressed in this way, it is part of the relationship of Israel, of his people, with God. It's the way that God has chosen to reveal his mind to them, the way he needs them to walk, if they're to walk in harmony with him, their Lord, the covenant Lord. And as long as they would keep a sense of God's presence amongst them, they would be faithful. Again, look at that picture that I've been painting of those ancient treaties. You have the two groups again, and they come eventually to the end of settling this covenant. It's put in place, and then the king, the victor, goes back to his palace. The other goes on, and he starts to pay tribute, usually, and what have you. And we read stories of this happening in Israel and Judah much later on. And if the, let's say, the king of Judah, who was under the king of Babylon, and exactly that kind of situation. And the king of Judah, eventually, he feels as though the king of Babylon is a long way away, he doesn't really care about me, therefore I'm going to stop paying tribute. He's rebelling. He's rebelling against the stipulations that have been set in front of him. He thinks he's perfectly safe to do it. But in no time at all, the king of Babylon is down on top of him. And really, that's something, a useful picture, I think, of this kind of setting as well. That it was necessary for the people to be conscious of God, God's near presence, the fearful God, indeed, and to remain faithful to him under that. Not to rebel, not to discard him, not to say, well, it doesn't really matter, I can do as I please. To maintain a sense themselves of that relationship which he's established with them. So I'm setting this up. This is a crucial stage in Israel's development. We have seen over time God made a covenant with Adam. He renewed a covenant with Noah and developed it further. He made a covenant with Abraham. He made it very specific to Abraham and his family. He's renewing it now. We call it the Mosaic Covenant. But it's not just Moses. He's speaking to the people as a nation. Moses being the leader of them. But as well as that, just bearing it in mind today, you will often have people referring to the Ten Commandments. And there's value in that. But that we also try to get our attitude to this law, to get it right. And it is hard to do that. But to remember, the setting of it may help. But these 10 words, 10 commandments, they're about keeping our covenant Lord in front of us. And remembering that he is a covenant Lord. He's not a distant God who just orders people around and then leaves them to get on with it. He's there in relationship with the people of Israel. It's all part of this covenant that he's entering into with those who will obey him, who will come to him, who will believe in him, who will trust in him. And that applies all today as well. And it's within that relationship and being part of his realm as king that we're then enabled to uphold such stipulations as the people were given then. And in that sense, there is no real difference. They were still dependent on God's grace in those days. It was impossible for them to keep it without God's grace. Just as it is, and as Paul and others deal with at such length in the New Testament for us today. It's not that we achieve anything ourselves by that law. But if we are to find benefit from it at all, that we should remember the framework in which it is set. Be grateful for that, and to make use of it in order to please him as he upholds his covenant with his people. Now that is only a glimpse of a major topic, but also to try and help us to see just how big it was in the life of Israel as God's chosen people, and endeavor to build further upon it ourselves in future weeks. So may God bless his word to us this evening. Let us pray together.